And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today, both being shared in honor of Pride Month. The first is from the Morning Show Archives, an interview that I recorded and initially broadcast 20 years ago, back in 2005. For the next few minutes, I have the pleasure of speaking with Robert Trachtenberg, whose fashion and celebrity photos have shown up in New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, Entertainment Weekly, and a number of other publications. And he is responsible for a very, very interesting, I dare say, unique book, which has just been released, called When I Knew. And in this book, a number of different people, I think over 100 of them in all, share a very interesting story, a story which they all have in common in a sense, and yet the way it plays out for each of them is different. Each of these people is gay, some men, some women, all gay, and for each of them, they share the story of that moment when they knew they were gay. And the range of stories here is actually quite remarkable, and range from the hilariously funny to the very, very poignant. And we're going to be speaking with Robert Trachtenberg about this this remarkable book and what is behind it. Robert Trachtenberg, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us how you got the idea to do something like this.
I got the idea for this from, you spend a lot of time on photo shoots waiting for either an actress or a model to come out of hair and makeup. Literally, sometimes it can be 3 or 4 hours. And so you have a whole crew and people hanging around, sort of just waiting. And people start talking. It's sort of the equivalent of a campfire. People start telling stories. And so these stories would start coming out, and I didn't know what to do with them. I just knew they were funny anecdotes. And then finally, I think it was Andrew Friedman's story about being 9 years old and watching the evening news in 1969 with his father, and the announcer coming on and saying that Judy Garland had died and Andrew fainted. I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back, and I thought, well, there's got to be a book here. So I started collecting them in earnest. And we went on from there.
When you went about collecting, first of all, are we talking about all people that you already knew or who maybe crossed your path professionally?
No. Several of them have crossed my path professionally, but the majority of them I actually have never even met. It became a sort of 6 degrees of separation where I would call people that I knew, and sometimes they would say, I don't have a story particularly, but so-and-so has a great story. Here's their number. Here's their email. And it would go from there.
There are some people in this book that are very well known, but there are a lot of names that I happen not to recognize. Are all of these people that are to varying degrees famous, or are some of these people rather ordinary people, if you know what I mean?
Actually, the bulk, at the very, very beginning of the book, in the table of contents, it has the person's name and what they do, their occupation, and the majority of them are not famous, which is actually, I have to say, a thing that I'm sort of proud of, because we did have some more famous people in there. And, well, we didn't have them in there. They had sent me their stories, and I didn't include them because, quite frankly, their stories weren't that interesting, and I didn't think that just being a celebrity was enough to get you a ticket into the book. Your story had to be unique and funny or poignant, and so just being a celebrity was not enough to get you in.
So. I'm glad you mentioned the table of contents. I've read the book, but somehow I missed the table of contents altogether.
Don't worry.
And now I'm looking at it with my own eyes, and you're absolutely right. We do see a few people here that are listed as mother or pharmaceutical executive.
Yeah.
But we should say, too, that at a glance at least, the vast majority of people here seem to be involved in one way or another in the entertainment industry.
Yeah, I have to admit. And, you know, somebody did say to me, another interviewer said to me, you know, why isn't there a better cross-section, people in terms of what they do for a living? And I said to him, you know, I absolutely reached out to, you know, firemen, doctors, professional athletes, all these people who are out. And they, once again, like the celebrities, they did send me stories. They just weren't very good. And I was really concerned that every page matter, that every page be good. And I didn't think at the end of the day that it mattered if you were a fireman, if you had a boring story, you know, because it didn't, you weren't a fireman when you knew it, in most cases. It didn't really, it wasn't really germane to the story itself. So I thought it was more important to get really good stories. Then that was the number one goal.
I really did find this book very, very interesting and entertaining, and it really got me thinking. It is kind of an interesting question, though, that in making this choice that you were just talking about of devoting the pages of this book only to interesting stories or entertaining stories, that also in some respects sort of steers around the reality that maybe in many cases this moment of revelation is not accompanied by sunlight bursting through the clouds or dramatic music in the background, that sometimes this is a moment which at least seems to, for some people, play out in a very ordinary kind of way.
Well, that's what was so interesting, was the range and the variety, as you said before, of, you know, what I call these eureka moments, because it's not, the book is sort of jokingly divided up in no particular order into when I knew. These stories range from when I knew, when my parents knew. You know, that Judy Garland story, for example, is something where Andrew's father, you know, that was kind of when my parents knew, when he fainted. You know, there's even a when the maid knew. And there's the occasional coming out story, but sprinkled in there. But the thing is that it's that eureka moment, that moment when it sort of all crystallizes for the particular person.
It's interesting you should mention the whole matter of coming out, because it seems to me that that is something which has been written about and discussed much more extensively than what most of these stories are about. For whatever reason, that's just something that we haven't devoted very much attention to.
Well, that's the thing. It's because when I started this, a lot of the time, it was that eureka moment tended to be a one-liner. You know, to use a showbiz expression, it was it was something like what's his name? Howard Bragman, who's in the book. I knew I was gay when the most exciting part of my bar mitzvah was meeting with the party planner. So they were. They started out to be one-liners, and I actually thought it was going to be a book of, you know, one-liners, page-turners. And as it turned out, when I sent out letters asking people for their stories, I said, you know, it can be as short as one sentence or as long as a paragraph. And some people, as you see, having the book there, ignored me. And I'm really happy they did, because they sent in longer, really funny, touching stories that were much more complex and diverse, and it really helped flesh out the book and make it much more, have just more range and depth than it would have had it just been a book of one-liners.
We're speaking with Robert Trachtenberg. His book is called When I Knew. One of the most poignant moments in this book is when someone by the name of Tom Gilbert shares his story, and in the midst of all of them, which are really very, very humorous, I think this is a story worth talking about. Tell our listeners about Tom Gilbert's experience.
Tom, in, I guess it was junior high in Florida, he, you know, at the end of the year, you have everyone sign your yearbook, which is a, you know, age-old tradition. And he had some kid signed his yearbook along on a page where everyone else was signing, and it said, you're a nice kid even though you're a fairy. And he signed his name. And Tom was so ashamed because he realized that the kid was right, but no one had ever said it before, and it had been something he had been thinking about in the most vague way. And this kid kind of crystallized it for him. But he was really ashamed. What he ended up doing was he ended up crossing out the word fairy and writing in something, I think, like goof or something like that.
Nut.
And making it look like the kid had changed his mind. So he altered the kid's inscription. So if his parents saw the yearbook, he sort of hid it, essentially. And it's a really touching story because he still has the yearbook. And, in fact, we reprinted the page as it was. And it's just kind of chilling, you know, to just see it right there.
Right. Well, and particularly besides some of the other things which are more standard. To a great kid, see you next year, have fun this summer, good luck in 69, Kevin.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of four or five such inscriptions which we see reprinted, but then right in the midst of this is this thing from this so-called friend named Philip.
Yeah.
He also mentions the fact that beside the word fairy, which he crossed out and then wrote above it nut, then off to the side he wrote a little sorry to make it look like Philip had...
It's really touching that you know, the extremes to which back then, you know, and it's so funny also how times have changed. I mean, the stories in the book range from Arthur Lawrence is in there who wrote... Arthur Lawrence wrote the script for West Side Story and the movie script for The Way We Were, and, you know, a really tremendous respected writer. And he's in his 80s, and he gave us a story. And then you have, I don't know, I think people in their late 20s. So the story spanned 50 years, and it's really interesting to, you know, to see the range like that. What's also cool is that, like we were saying about Tom Gilbert's yearbook, in a lot of cases we have photos of sometimes even the moment. We have Howard Bragman at his bar mitzvah and a couple other pictures of that, the event that they're describing, which is really fantastic. Or pictures of these people at the age their story takes place. So it's really cool to be able to, you know, get that visual reference right away.
You have another interesting story in here from actor Dan Butler. Now, do I remember correctly, is he a Bulldog on Frasier?
Yes.
Okay.
Bulldog on Frasier.
His is also far from a one-liner. I mean, he really gives some meat to his story. I mean, some context. He talks about how, as a senior in high school, he had been attracted to boys growing up, especially athletes and dancers. But he said, "My friendships with boys were fierce, life and death affairs, but I thought that was natural and that everyone felt the same way I did, and that if they didn't, they should." And he goes on to say he went out with girls and this and that. I mean, here was someone who was feeling all these feelings and yet at that point in time was really, truly, authentically, did not actually know what these feelings were. It's very interesting to hear someone talk about that.
Well, you know, what it comes down to actually is, you know, somebody was talking to me about this and they said, "Well, did you have any goal in mind with the book?" And I said, "Well, just to finish it would be great." But, you know, the thing is that I thought that if it had any kind of crossover appeal, meaning that if a parent was curious, and they thought maybe their son or daughter was gay, and they wanted to, you know, help ease that transition for them, or if a child wanted to help ease the transition to tell their parent, that would be very cool too, because you realize when you read stories like this that it's not a choice, which is, I don't think anybody, the angst and anxiety and, you know, drama that you go through, I don't think anybody would choose that. So it really makes you realize that being gay is not a choice. Nobody signs up for it, you know? So that was a really interesting revelation that hopefully will come out of this, because with stories like Dan's, next to these one-liners. Mm. So that was kind of cool that just became a byproduct of all the funny stuff.
It's interesting, too, how people responded to this invitation. I mean, some, as Dan Butler and Tom Gilbert, really very seriously, and then others really sort of play with the question. I'm thinking of, for instance, one of the women in the book, Jenny Allard, says, I knew in my 20s when I kept waking up with women.
Yeah.
I mean, that's her way of answering the question. And there's certainly others. Artist Chip Kidd has a real humorous thing about knowing from the moment his doctor slapped his behind in the delivery room.
Yeah.
Are some of these other stories, is it possible for us to even know just how authentic and real these stories are, or are some of these rather elaborately embroidered? And as far as you're concerned, is that okay?
I think that for the for the sort of overall texture of the book, you know, because it's now scattered with these funny stories and, like I said, these one-liners versus Dan Butler and Tom Gilbert and other people, I've been told it makes for really good reading, because you just sort of, you know, have these sort of ups and downs and kind of funny little asides, and then you get to more meaty stuff. So it kind of makes for a good mix overall. You know, I mean, yes, they're definitely one-liners. They're very, ba-dum-bum. But they're, there's definitely a grain of truth in all of them.
Mm.
I
wonder if you have any concern about the fact that some of these stories very much reinforce some of the stereotypes which are out there about what gay people are like and what they're interested in and that kind of thing. In the same sort of way that, for instance, a show that I think entertains a lot of people, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, is that what that's called?
Yeah. That
for as amusing as that show is and sometimes heartwarming or whatever, it also, in effect, reinforces, and it almost seems consciously so, many of the stereotypes about what interests a typical gay man, for instance. Do you have any concerns about that? Is that a possible drawback here, or kind of a hidden negative factor that we should talk about?
I think that, I set a couple of rules for myself when I started this. One was I wasn't going to include anything that I really wanted this to be essentially a coffee table book, where if you had it out on the coffee table and your mom or dad came by, they could pick it up and not drop it in disgust. So I didn't, no dirty stories, to put it in a kind of funny way. No dirty stories.
Nothing very graphic, certainly.
Nothing very graphic. That's a much more mature way of saying it. And one Judy Garland story and one Barbara Streisand story. I was limiting myself to one each, because obviously they're icons in the gay community for some people. I'm saying that in a sort of funny sort of way, but I think that's what you're referring to. You know, I think that there is truth in stereotypes. I think people want to be so politically correct that they don't, that they're scared to acknowledge it. I think that
I'm thinking, for instance, of what Scott Miller writes. It's really cute, and it's very brief. I maybe should just read it.
Sure.
He says, I suppose I was a musical prodigy, but it was my third birthday, and my copy of the soundtrack album of The King and I had broken. Hearing of my heartbreak over the loss, my aunt bought me a new copy. I remember unwrapping it, instantly filled with disappointment. This is the show. I wanted the movie soundtrack. The orchestrations are so much better. And the, and the implication in Scott Miller's little story there is that only a gay young man could possibly care about something like that or notice something like that.
Right. Well, he is actually, but he is one of the people that I know, and he is probably first and foremost a true musical prodigy. Even though he's into his adult life, he is nuts. He is an incredible musical prodigy, and very well versed in all that stuff. And actually, yes, I don't know what this. I don't know the origin of it. I don't know why. It's not for me to say, but it's not everyone. But you know, they do like a nice Broadway soundtrack every once in a while.
I think another interesting story, you know, which is a more serious approach to your question, is that of John McPherson. And this is really, I mean, it speaks directly to what we were just talking about. But here's a young man who had brothers that played baseball and so on. But he himself was intensely interested in music and ballet. I mean, he would sit and listen to Swan Lake or Sleeping Beauty. And he tells the story of a former babysitter coming to the door accompanied by her new husband, who was a naval officer. And just that brief little encounter was one of those really painful moments where he realized in just sort of a new way how out of step he was from the more standard ideas of what it meant to be masculine.
Right. It's that moment when you realize you're different from the other kids. Yeah. A lot of the time, and, you know, I think it changes every year. I'm hoping, I know there's steps backward steps, but you talk to people in their 20s now, and it gets easier. But I think that story takes place in the mid to early 60s or something like that. And it's that painful moment when you do realize that, you know, you're different, and someone points it out to you.
Right.
It's kind of okay if you know it and it's your little secret, but when it's sort of laid bare for everyone to see, it's kind of painful.
Right. And speaking of stereotypes, I love Larry Wideman's story when he says, my mom told me on the phone that she and Dad had just seen the movie Philadelphia, and he knew that it was time to tell.
Right.
He asked her if she was sitting down. She knew right away what I was about to tell her and immediately shouted, oh, no, but you watch football.
Yeah. So it kind of works. It kind of works both ways, you know, what people's expectations are of what it is to be a guy. The other interesting thing that came of this was that because there's women in the book, and as you mentioned, Jenny Allard and some other women, and it was really interesting to me how it broke down between men and women, because the women, you know, the thing is that if a girl is a tomboy, she's not going to get as much grief as a little boy who's possibly not conforming to what society believes, a little man should be. And it was really interesting because it was difficult to get stories from women. It was a completely different ball of wax. I was really surprised. It was a completely different sensibility. It broke down in a completely different way.
We've touched on the fact that there are some stories here that are very poignant and maybe even really verge on the outright painful, of course. But it's probably important for us to also say that this book does not really delve into what is a very sad reality for many people, where sometimes these moments of self-awareness or revelation can also lead to really terrible things. That's not really what this book is about either.
This is much lighter. This is much, much lighter. And obviously I was aware that that those eureka moments or coming out or things like that could lead to some sad and tragic consequences. But this wasn't this book. This book was meant to be much more lighthearted. And, besides the photos I had mentioned, when there wasn't an appropriate photo, we had this really terrific guy, Tom Bechtel, who does illustrations every week for Entertainment Weekly and The New Yorker, capture the story in illustration form. And as you can see, it has a much lighter, colorful tone than that was for something else. I mean, that's not what I was after here.
Right. And there are certainly moments here which are very optimistic or hopeful, and one likes to think about this scenario playing out for young people in this kind of moment. One of my favorite moments in the book is the story of Stephen Orr.
Yeah.
Down in Texas in 1971. Do you want to tell it, or should I just read it?
Why don't you just read it?
He says, "My father was tossing a football with my brothers in the front yard. Seeing me sitting alone on the steps, my mother took my dad aside. Dub," she said, calling my dad by his nickname. "I think Steve is feeling a little left out. Why don't you ask him if he'd like to play, too?" So my dad walked over. "Want to throw the football some?" he asked. I'd really rather go pick flowers," I replied. And we did. My father, a football coach, spent the rest of the afternoon picking flowers with me in a nearby field.
Yeah, people love this story because we actually have a photo of Steve picking flowers in that field, which is incredible that he had a photo of that. The thing is also that came about that was really interesting from all this is that, a bunch of cases, the people who sent me stories, their stories turned out to relate directly to what they did as a profession. Steve, we talked about this earlier, about the table of contents. Steve is the garden editor at a major magazine.
Ah.
Howard Bragman, who wanted to meet with the party planner at his bar mitzvah, is a publicist here in Hollywood, but one of the big things he does is he plans these huge Oscar and Cannes Film Festival-related parties. There's another terrific example of this where the people became what their passion was at that early age. So when you talk about, stereotypes or something, in many cases, that interest became a vocation.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it happened at least five or six times. I can't remember offhand some of the others, but it's really great.
I noticed at the end of the little biography of you that the last three words of your biography are, "He always knew."
Right. And, that's what I was sort of mentioning earlier when you asked me how I gathered the stories, is what I immediately started doing was, calling people I knew who I thought were very, very funny. And, it was my natural first go-around was to get a hold of these people. And in a lot of cases, like my case, they said, you'd think I'd have a story, wouldn't you? I mean, because obviously these friends of mine are not shy, and they say, I'm funny, I'm witty, and they say I'm smart. But they said, you know what? I don't have a story. I always knew. And that was the case for me, and that's why I don't have a story in the book, and I think that... that happens, which is also another reason why you realize it's kind of not a choice, because I kind of always knew.
Hmm.
So, there you go.
You've touched just a little bit on how the book has been received. By and large, what is your impression of how people have received this book, both in and out of the gay community?
You know, I would never have imagined the response. It's been, you know, People Magazine said it was, you know, the buzz book to have, and Newsweek did something on it, and, you know, it's going to be the Today Show and Nightline are doing things on it, and, you know, papers all over the country have done stuff, and so it's been incredible because I would have never imagined this. It's had this tremendous crossover appeal so far, which has been really heartwarming, and people just have this real affection for it that I'm really gratified by. I just think I'm not tooting my own horn because I didn't art direct it and I wasn't the illustrator, but I think it was a nice combination of the way it looks in combination with the art, the photos, and the way it's all laid out, and sort of the pacing that we were talking about, where it's not, there's a nice rhythm to it that people have really been responding to. So I've been thrilled. It's been terrific.
Have any concerns been raised that you can think of, or not really? I mean, people that were in any way offended by it, or felt like you were making light of something that should be this profound moment?
No, actually, that's never come up once, and I've done a lot of stuff now, radio and TV and print, and that's never come up, because I think that they're relieved that it's kind of lighthearted but respectful.
Right. You know? Yeah, a delicate balancing act, it seems to me, and I do think you achieve that. And maybe your timing is perhaps impeccable, too, in that maybe a few years ago, maybe many years ago, of course, this book would have not been an impossibility, probably.
Right.
And maybe even a few years ago, it maybe would not have been received as comfortably as it is.
Right. I mean, I think that things like Will and Grace and Queer Eye and all that have helped. Absolutely, yeah. But again, I think it's also because it's what we were saying. I mean, I didn't want to include any graphic stories. You know, I just wanted to just keep the thing light and moving and fun. And so I think people respond to that. I'm not trying to preach to anyone. And, you know, it's just kind of a fun read.
Might there be a sequel?
There actually might and probably will be, but it probably will not be exclusively gay. It will expand beyond that. So,
well, the book we've been talking about is called When I Knew. It's published by Regan Books. The story is gathered and edited by Robert Trachtenberg. Robert Trachtenberg, it was a great pleasure to speak with you today on
Thank
the morning
you.
Show. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
And for part two of today's program here on WGTD, and in keeping with June as Pride Month, I am excited to speak with best-selling author Christopher Rice. He writes under the pen name of C. Travis Rice about the latest of his novels that primarily involve queer men. And his latest novel, his latest romance, called Party of Three. And we do want to mention, before we go any further, that Christopher Rice, or C. Travis Rice, whichever you prefer, has quite a lineage in his family. He is the son of acclaimed writer Anne Rice. And we'll be talking about his book and also what it's like to have a mother who is one of the most famous authors in the country. And again, this latest book by C. Travis Rice is called Party of Three. C. Travis Rice, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I think that's the first time I've ever been welcomed to a show as C. Travis Rice, formally and officially. So it's an exciting moment for the brand. Thank you for having me.
There you go. Glad to be talking with you. And we will get to Party of Three in just a moment. But, of course, I do need to ask you, what it was like to grow up with Anne Rice as your mother. And was it a foregone conclusion, and very much with her encouragement that you have followed in her footsteps as a writer yourself?
No, it wasn't. She absolutely thought I was going to be an actor. That was where all of my passion seemed to lie when I was in high school and even younger than high school. And she was completely floored when I wrote a novel. I wrote it on a whim because she had suffered a major health crisis in New Orleans, and I was living in Los Angeles by then. And I had been called back home to be at her bedside. And as she made her recovery, I had a lot of downtime at home when I wasn't with her in the hospital. And I just started tinkering with this short story I had written and read at a reading series a couple months before in L.A. Never expected to write something that was novel length. Didn't think I could. I thought, if anything, I would try my luck in Hollywood at screenwriting, more dramatic writing, sort of take advantage of my theater experience as a younger person. So she was really astonished, absolutely supportive once it was clear that was what was happening. But I think the larger part of it, to go to the root of your question, is that the answer to how it is that it's wonderful if you want to be artistic and creative. It's wonderful to have artistic and creative parents in that regard, because they don't regard you as being demonically possessed, you know, whereas there are a lot of other, you know, family environments where they're like, you want to be a what, you know, because people don't understand, and sometimes I don't understand, how the business side of it works. When you tell your family, I'm going to go off to try to make a living at this, not just do this as a hobby or for fun on the weekends, but I'm actually going to try to have a career, that they say, well, where do you begin? And that's a very good question that we in the writing community still struggle with, and it changes by the day. But it was wonderful. We're going to have a wonderful celebration of life in her honor in New Orleans on November 1st. The tickets go on sale July 11th. It's called Anne Rice, an All Saints Day celebration. I'm sure you were aware we lost her several years ago, and we couldn't have a big public funeral at the time because of COVID restrictions in New Orleans, which we absolutely supported. So now we're doing, because some time has passed, we're able to have the event be kind of celebratory and not just a sad black-clad funeral.
Very good. So let's talk for a moment about this book and the way in which it is part of a series and yet a book that stands alone and can be enjoyed simply on its own if a given reader so chose. First of all, talk about the series of which it is a part, and then to what extent this book can be both enjoyed and even understood apart from knowing any of the books that have come before it.
Well, you know, forgive me for nerding out about the process of publishing a book, but this is one of the things that I think is incredibly exciting about digital fiction and romance fiction in general, which is that they experiment with length and format. And I think back in the old days of publishing, when I was a young person and my mother was really first hitting the top of the bestseller list, publishers didn't want to publish shorter works because there was a point of diminishing returns where the shipping and the warehousing of little novellas that were bound and printed, the price point for the novella couldn't justify the cost of distributing it. Well, digital publishing did away with all of that. And so a lot of writers, but I would say romance writers in particular, started experimenting with full-fledged works that were shorter than a novel. And that was something I very much wanted to do as part of the Sapphire Cove series. The Sapphire Cove novels are long for the most part. They're big books. They're, I call them gay Nora Roberts novels because I'm a big Nora Roberts fan, but she's sort of, you know, atmospheric third person. Some vestiges of the saga, which used to be a far more popular format in fiction, the historical family saga in the 80s and 90s were really big and kind of a staple. They've sort of gone by the wayside. I was hoping to bring them back, but I was doing my version of it. You know, I think romance novels in which both of the romantic heroes were men became increasingly popular around 2014, 2015. There started to be a big market for it, but it was a conversation piece that almost all of them were written, or I should say many of them were written by authors who identified as women. And this was very controversial and provocative for a lot of people. And it, in me, it led to a lot of contempt prior to investigation. And then I started reading some of these books, and I just absolutely fell in love with them because they keep the central promise that the heroes are not going to break up or die. You know, so much of what we consider love stories, particularly in the LGBT community over time, are defined by tragedy and loss. And a romance novel makes a promise from the outset, I'm not going to do that to you in this time. Maybe every other book will do it. But this, you know, so I, during the early lockdowns of COVID here in Southern California where I live, I made up this fantastical, well, not fantastical, it's grounded in reality, but it was a Technicolor, glossy beachfront resort where I wanted to basically plant all of these stories over time, over the course of the series. And this is one that is designed for people who may not know the series. It's a nice entry point. It's a sampler, if you will. There's some references to past characters in the beginning, but they're mostly the storytellers for this standalone story. And it's very... Yeah, it is very much for an older crowd. Let's just put it that way. If the cover doesn't give it away, this is for mature readers.
Ah, there you go. I quite agree.
Yes.
And one of the things that I find intriguing about the novel and really beautiful is that it dares to approach that whole matter of who are you really? And have you come to terms with who you are? Or who you were, or who you want to be.
Right.
And sometimes that can be a process that is incredibly painful and aimless and frustrating. And sometimes it can be a beautiful journey of discovery. And it seems like we have a little bit of all of that in the journey of at least one of your main characters here.
Yes, absolutely. I love, that's my preference in terms of romance fiction. I think there is nothing more, what's the word I'm looking for? There's nothing more hypnotic than someone who is willing to work on their most difficult issues for the sake of you and your relationship, regardless of what gender you are, what sexual orientation you are. Somebody who says, I value being with you so much that I'm going to really take a hard and challenging look at the parts of myself that are keeping me from you, that I don't want to be keeping me from you. That is an inspiring concept for me. I think it can be a swooningly romantic concept, and it's very much in this book. But, you know, this book is about an unconventional relationship structure. It is about three people who come together in what we would commonly call a throuple. But this was a whole genre of romance fiction when I first started investigating the business of it. And it really rattled my sense of romance as only being about a certain type of woman and a certain type of man, only being the sort of Harlequin model. I saw that, again, largely thanks to the fact that people could take creative risks because they were working in digital and they didn't have to worry about the print distribution costs of books. They could try new things. And so there was a subgenre, as they would call it, of books about three people ending up in I guess what they would call a polyamorous relationship, but that implies that they are not exclusive with each other. And so I think that's an even more interesting concept. It's hard enough to have a relationship with one person. How do you do it with two at the same time? And you're all three connected in the same way. It makes for a wonderful writing experience. There's a lot of material there.
It's a wonderful reading experience as well. Again, this romance novel is called Party of Three. And the name on the cover, C. Travis Rice, the pen name of Christopher Rice. Mr. Rice, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was great to talk with you and very interesting and fun to explore your newest book. Best wishes to you.
To you too, sir. Thanks for having me.
I want to mention the interviews that are going to be shared this weekend in the podcast version of The Morning Show. Tomorrow, Saturday, we're going to be returning to a topic that we touched on back on June 18th when I spoke with Roger Karp from Classic Trains Magazine about his book celebrating the 125th anniversary of Lionel Model Trains. To follow up on that, tomorrow I'm sharing a portion of an interview I recorded back in 2004 with Sam Posey, whose wonderful book is called Playing with Trains, A Passion Beyond Scale. In this book, he talks about his own love of model trains and what it has meant for him in his life, and also talks us through some of the specifics that are involved in this hobby and the ways in which it can truly engulf you in some really wonderful and exciting ways. That's tomorrow's podcast. On Sunday, we're going to be turning to the topic of marital equality and same-sex marriage in anticipation of an interview that is going to be broadcast on Monday's show. On Sunday's podcast, I'm replaying two interviews that I recorded back in 2009. The first with conservative columnist and commentator Andrew Sullivan, talking about his book Same-Sex Marriage, Pro and Con. After that, George Chauncey and his book Why Marriage? The History Shaping Today's Debate Over Gay Equality. I'm sharing those on Sunday because on Monday I'll be broadcasting a conversation with Frankie Frankeny, co-author of the book Love, The Heroic Stories of Marriage Equality. We're focusing on this because this month marks the 10th anniversary of the landmark 2015 Supreme Court decision, which established marriage equality as the law of the land throughout the United States. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. And for the podcast version of the program, in order to enjoy a different morning show 7 days a week, be sure to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's available through Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts. Again, The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
Morning, I should say. I'm Scott Nelson for WGTD, and just looking at our weather trend for today and this weekend, a cloudy but calm night this evening, and a beautiful weekend ahead as the sun returns for both Saturday and Sunday, with high temps in the mid to upper 80s throughout the weekend. A slight chance for showers and thunderstorms on Sunday and Monday, with temps